And we just hope for better weather at some point. Okay, I want to give you an opportunity to ask questions about the old test, because I know some of you have questions. Before you do, I want to give back your homework. And this is the one on the carbon distributions. Two main comments. I think probably about half of you messed up somewhere in the calculations. And in some cases, it was difficult to tell exactly, you know, what got messed up. But I think what a number of you did is use the horizon depths rather than the thicknesses when you're multiplying out the values to come up with the stock for a horizon. In other words, if a horizon extends from 20 to 50 centimeters, it's 30 centimeters thick, right? And that's the number you're using because that's the proportion of that 1 meter depth of that horizon. And if you use just the bottom depth, you know, 50 centimeters, then you're going to end up really overestimating the amount of carbon in the profile. And then the second thing about, you know, which is the forest soil, which is the grassland soil, I think pretty much all of you got that right, with the idea that the grassland soil is the one that has more carbon in the upper part of the soil. The reasons for it, though, there's some odd comments. I just wanted to maybe point out that if you're thinking about a reason for why you get that different distribution, what I would suggest is you consider the inputs of organic material into a forest soil versus a grassland soil. And in the grassland soil, the primary carbon inputs are in the form of these roots, the very fine and fine roots that turn over pretty rapidly, and so you get this fairly high concentration of carbon in the upper part of the soil, and it extends down to a depth. Now in a forest, where do most of the carbon inputs come from?
It's the litter,
and so you might have a O-horizon sitting up there on top that's got a fair amount of carbon in it, but in terms of the carbon that is actually in the mineral soil, it's not going to be nearly as much because you don't have the same mechanism for carbon inputs. And that's really one of the fundamental differences between grasslands and forests, is that way in which carbon gets added back to the soil. Okay? So I'll give these back to you, and I gotta wait till the end of class. But how about questions on the old test? Are there any? No? Okay.
Oh, I got a bunch.
All right. Let's.
So number 11.
Number 11, okay. Let's see if I can. Okay, soils indicated by X and Y, and the hill slope diagrams below both contain A horizons.
No.
10, 11. Well, this was actually from last time, right?
Yeah.
This number 11?
I don't know. I mean, we had a question about the same thing, but
okay, well, all you'd have to do here, if you were plotting annual range productivity as a function of annual precip.
It's a curve, right?
Well, probably, but it's definitely going to be something that with increasing annual precipitation, the annual range productivity increases, right? And then if you're looking at the below ground part, it says draw a line or curve that illustrates the A horizon thickness. And that would probably look something like that, if you remember that figure that we went over. And again, that A horizon is just a fossil record of the past productivity of that site. So the more productivity you've had on the site, the better expression of the A horizon you're going to see. Yeah?
Right. Okay, question number 7, why are soils often described as clay factories?
Yeah, why are soils often described as clay factories? Anybody want to remember that cartoon I showed you?
It's derived from the concept 9. The concept 9, the one on the...
Oh, right, yeah, the concept number 9, which I guess there's a number of different ways of saying it, but it's that all the clay-sized material that we have on Earth probably formed in a soil environment. I mean, that's what happens. You take these minerals that formed under very different conditions, usually lots of heat and pressure, you stick them up in a near surface environment, and thermodynamically they're not stable, they tend to weather, and over time, the net result is you get clays formed. And the clays can be these layer silicates, it can be iron oxides, aluminum oxides. You know, we talked about a number of different types, but that's just essentially what goes on in soil. And if you project that over time, you know, we'd end up with all clay-sized material.
So you could answer that by saying, clay is old, and so eventually that's what it's going to get to?
Well, I wouldn't say clay is old. I'd say that given the conditions in the soil, that primary minerals are going to continually be weathering, and the final product is going to be clay-sized material. Okay? Yeah, Mateo?
In the first question, when we have to indicate increase, decrease, or stay the same.
Okay.
I was a little bit confused because if I was thinking about a BW and then a BT, I was imagining that the secondary mineral increased with that, as well as the weather.
Well, I'd say having a BW over BT is going to be fairly unusual.
Okay.
Just consider a normal, let's call it an ABCR type of soil profile, okay? And if you think of it that way, where are most of the secondary minerals going to be? Yeah, they're going to be up towards the surface because that's where you have the greatest intensity of weathering, which is also part of that question. And as you keep going down in that soil profile, you're going to get into less weathered material, right?
Okay.
So you would expect the primary minerals or the abundance of primary minerals to increase.
As well as the metal humus complex will be freezing.
Right, because to have metal humus complexes, you've got to have humus, right? And most of that's going to be in the upper part of the soil. So as you go down, you would expect those to decrease as well. And really, think about it, these metal humus complexes are it's a type of secondary mineral, something that tends to form in a lot of soils. All right, yes?
It's written, I don't remember the question, but the thickness of a horizon, where do you find it?
Was it number 10?
Number 6.
Six. Okay. This was actually from last time, too. You guys had a question pretty similar.
But then I was thinking about slides of topography, where we have a thicker a horizon south aspect. So this is...
Okay, but in this one of the keys here, I'll stop you, is that you've got the soil, grassland soil, North Dakota, one in New Mexico, and this last line, assuming all other factors equal. So they're on the same sort of landscape position. All the other things other than temperature are going to be the same, okay? So just the point of the question is just what is the net effect of temperature if you isolate that as a factor in soil formation. And as I said, this was on the last one, and most of you said something about the soil from North Dakota have a thicker, probably darker A horizon because there's less decomposition, so greater accumulation of organic matter in the soil. Yeah.
I thought when I was looking at the clay thing, it said that when the plate, when it was coming towards the surface, when the temperature was lowered, was when you saw more increased weathering. And I was curious about that graph up there, if that was true or not.
Say that again. You were looking at what?
The clay had a little cartoon thing, and it said when you lowered the pressure and temperature, and you kind of exposed it to like be weathered, to be decomposition, and for it to increase in weathering.
For clay, I'm not sure what. What exactly you're talking about? And you're this one.
So it would increase linearly, right?
Which?
Just mean those graphs.
Yeah.
The first graph.
This right here, intensity of weathering, mean annual soil temperature. Just in general, what does temperature do to the rates of chemical or biochemical reactions? It speeds them up. So since a lot of weathering is chemical weathering, then you would expect with more higher temperatures, you're going to get increased rates of weathering or intensity of weathering. Okay? Yeah?
Would it be like a curve, though? Just would it like level off?
Oh, yeah. A lot of these. And I'm not necessarily looking for an exact exponential curve or logarithmic curve or anything like that. But just the general relationship. As temperature goes up, intensity of weathering would go up. But you're right, it probably would level off at some point.
I guess with those ones, I feel like I knew the general relationship, but I wasn't sure which ones would be curves and which ones wouldn't. And since you said draw lines or curves, I thought maybe that would be
possible. I'm not that picky about it.
Okay.
If you show the like in this case, that it's going up.
Okay.
The Kansas grassland one, can you go down to that one?
Well, are we done with this one? Did you have a
Craig? Mine is the same as hers.
Okay.
And so the other one goes...
Which one? This?
The one next to it. Yeah, can we just finish?
Okay. So if I was drawing a curve here, mean annual precip, depth to calcium carbonate.
Just be down.
Yeah, so something like this. And in fact, you've got a figure in your notes that's almost that exact same thing.
And then this one,
intensity of weathering as you get more annual precip. Since a lot of those weathering reactions involve water, you would expect those to increase as well. Okay, now the one about Kansas, where did that go? Oh, number 9. Soils from western Kansas and the Palouse region both receive 580 millimeters, 23 inches of annual precip. Soil from Kansas has a BK horizon at depth of 60 centimeters. The Palouse soil does not have a BK horizon. So assuming all other factors to be similar, how can you explain the difference in morphology? So same annual precip. Why would you see this sort of a difference?
It being a more arid region, Kansas, but doesn't seem right. Just more calcium carbonate?
Well, but we're saying they've got the same annual precip. So given that, I'd say the degree of aridity is the same.
Difference in
favor? All other soil forming factors similar. So let's say they formed in less.
The season. One is in spring, so the crop uptake immediately, and the other is in winter.
So yeah, it's the temporal distribution. And around here, when do we get most of our precip? Well, it's over the winter. And what are the plants doing then? Not much. They're sleeping. Senescing, whatever you want to call it. And as a result, a greater proportion of that precipitation is able to move down through the soil and move calcium carbonate. In Kansas, most of the precip comes during growing season where it is more effectively used by the vegetation, so you have a much smaller proportion that's actually available to move down through the soil. So I guess you could think of it as effective leaching as a result of the difference in when the precipitation comes. So it's not just total amount, but it's the seasonal distribution that's really important too.
Since we're down on 10, can we, because I'm a little confused, because the X looks to me steeper, but then it looks like it could be collecting and Y could be shedding?
Well, yeah, on this one, it really doesn't matter if you're looking at it either the plan view or the side view, but with the figure there on the left, number 10, where the X is, you would expect convergent water flow, right? And on where Y is, you would expect divergent flow. And the idea is that if you get convergent flow, even if it's just water, okay, where are you going to get more production? Well, where you've got more water or where you get a concentration of water flow. So just from that standpoint, you would expect a thicker A horizon there. And the other thing, we talked a little bit about cumulization. And normally in concave areas, you would expect the accumulation of mineral material maybe from upslope as a result of erosion. So you might get an over-thickened A horizon from that as well.
So X would be, that would have more.
Yeah, X would have the thicker A horizon. Bryce?
Do you care if we go off the, just talking about like the hill slope, the top?
Oh, that's fine.
Can we just go over, so like the summit is going to have a thicker B horizon? Or
in most cases, yes, because you said that's the most stable landscape position.
Okay. And then the shoulder is going to be it's going to be thinner and there's more shoulder than the side slope, there's more runoff?
Well, the shoulder is the real convex part of that slope profile. And so I think the way that it might be in your notes, it's the most actively downwearing. Okay? And I guess I would think about that as probably the greatest amounts of erosion are occurring there.
So the foot slope or whatever should be the one forming the most residual?
The foot slope?
Toe slope.
No, that would be the one where you'd expect the material from upslope to be accumulating.
Or colluvium, I mean.
Yeah. Okay, that's, yeah, exactly.
So residuum would probably be the top one?
Well, the shoulder, I think, would be the most likely, because that's the most actively downwearing one. So you're...
What does the backslope do in reference?
It sort of depends, but I think when we talked about the processes, we said that's transportation. Mm-hmm. In other words, things are moving through the backslope or on the backslope from top to bottom. And I think the one example I had was of an E horizon. And you could see this nice, very well expressed E horizon going down the backslope. And so it's just representing the movement of water through there, you know, in a downward sense or down slope direction. Yeah, Lee?
It's going to be really important for us to know like the composition of like allotane or ferrohydrate.
You should know what's in them. I'm not going to ask you for specific chemical formulas, okay?
Josh, proceed to my next question.
Yeah?
What's number C, was that allotane?
Let's see here. Up here?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, common secondary aluminosilicate found in volcanic ash soils. Couple of keys there, volcanic ash soils, and then aluminosilicate, meaning it's got aluminum and silicon in it. So, yeah, allophane would be the best answer. Mateo?
In this list, in the key, can be foot slope and toe slope?
Yeah, foot slope, toe slope, either of those would be fine.
Is that the colluvium just more in the foot slope?
Well, it's, I think you'd be hard pressed to make a real good distinction between the foot slope and a toe slope. They're kind of the same thing in terms of process. They're just, the toe slope is a little bit further out, so maybe a little less accumulation, a little less, probably just a little less accumulation, but either one of those is fine because they're depositional environments. Bryce?
Going off the testing, and this, like this, the octahedral and tetrahedral sheets, the 2-to-1, so you have silica on either side of aluminum.
Yeah, think of an Oreo cookie, all right, with the chocolate part being the silicon tetrahedral sheets.
Okay. And then what's the significance of that? What is it?
That's just the way that, hopefully one thing that you appreciate is that there's a lot of aluminum and silicon and oxygen in soils and in the Earth's crust. And that's nature's way of arranging those things in a fairly stable type of an arrangement that's not going to change or weather further very easily. So that's just the way they associate with one another.
Okay.
And in general, what's more weathered, a 2-to-1 layer silicate or a 1-to-1? Or which would you expect to find in a more weathered environment? Probably 1-to-1, because over time, you know, we lose silicon. And if you think about a 2-to-1 layer silicate, there's about twice as much silicon there as aluminum. But if you subject that to more intense weathering or longer weathering, eventually some of that silicon is going to get lost, and you just end up with a 1-to-1 layer silicate.
Can when we're looking at like a vermiculite, are we looking at just to see that what it's mica, the little mica, like a two to one clays that make up vermiculite? Is that what that would be? Is that all we need to know on that? Or?
Well, I guess I would hope that you're aware it's 2-to-1 layer silicate, and it's one of the weathering products that forms in soils. But like I said, I'm not going to ask you specific chemical formulas. Emily.
Where we have to number the profiles for age, or most rapidly formed.
Is it?
Yeah.
Yeah, okay.
Of course would be 1, A would be 2.
Okay, which one would be, so which one would be the most rapidly formed? Okay, the OI, I agree. Question 2.
And then I said A would be number 2.
Okay.
And then for BT and BHS, I was confused. I said 3 for BT and 4 for BHS, but I'm not.
I'd reverse those. Okay. Remember the example I gave you of the chrono sequence in Alaska where the Mendenhall Glacier is receding? And there's a good EBHS horizon sequence in that soil that's roughly 250 years old. So it's something, they can be older, but I think when I was giving you the range in years, you know, I think for the BHS, we said 10 to the second, 10 to the third, somewhere in that realm. Whereas the BT would be an order of magnitude more, probably 10 to the third, 10 to the fourth, somewhere in there. And then the BO, yeah, 10 to the fifth, 10 to the sixth, somewhere in there.
On your thing about organisms, I couldn't think of the third one.
Thing about organisms on this?
Number 8. Sorry.
Yeah, this was, I think you had a question like this on the last test. So, horizons, number 8, horizons that form directly as a result of organism activity. There are a lot of possibilities. I guess probably the most obvious ones would be something like an OI horizon or any sort of an organic horizon, because that's what? It's plant material in most cases, or it's produced from plant material like a peat in a peatland, which would be an OI. That's one. A lot of people put an A horizon down because the A horizon is generally going to form as a result of the input of organic matter from roots or incorporation of organic matter from litter material, either way. Let's see, what were some other good ones? The BG horizon. It's the microbes that are causing that glaying process by reducing the iron.
What about a BHS?
That one would work because there are certain vegetation types that directly promote that EBHS horizon sequence. I mentioned those kauri trees in New Zealand. That would be one example. A few I hadn't thought of. Some people put an A horizon with the U, except this says other than humans, doesn't it? I didn't put that on this year's exam, but some people use that subordinate distinction U, which means it contains human artifacts. So yeah, that would work as well. Yeah.
What do we need to know about the hematite, the geotite, and the ferrite? What would be the most, like, I know the differences between color, but what are we looking for?
Okay, you know, differences between color. Where might you find those?
Hematite would not be in really, like, highly weathered soils.
It would not be?
It would be.
Oh, okay, yeah, like in an oxisol, all right.
And geophyte, would that be like in weakly developed, because it's kind of yellow sand?
Well, the hematite would be the dominant iron oxide in well-drained tropical environments, generally warmer environments. You know, as you go further south, soils tend to get redder, and that's a reflection of increasing amounts of hematite. Around here, we don't have red soils, but something like that goethite would be the main iron oxide form. And it's more of a yellow or brown type of color. And then what about ferrihydrite?
We see that all.
In what kind of soils?
The ash cap.
Yeah, the ash cap soils. Any others? I think we've just about covered it, but it's good that you asked the question. It's fine, since, yeah.
Maybe I'm thinking about this too hard. 3A, the name of a poorly sorted superficial deposit, is that just glacial till?
That would be one. What else would work for a poorly sorted superficial deposit?
Colluvium.
Colluvium would work. Those are probably the two best answers I can think of. And poorly sorted just means what? What does poorly sorted mean?
Lots of different sizes?
Yeah, you've got a very wide range in particle sizes. Usually it could be everything from clays up through boulders and everything in between.
So for well sorted, would like alluvial
deposits stuff? Generally, yeah. What else would be a well sorted deposit?
Lacustrine.
Lacustrine would be another good example.
Lust.
Most windblown parent materials tend to be very well sorted. So when it's being carried by water or wind, generally that does a pretty good job of sorting things out according to a very narrow range of particle sizes. Yeah, Emily?
Just as far as general material goes, because there was a lot of overlap for the climate aspect on this that we covered in the first exam. But there wasn't anything with like the organization or the history on this one, so
right. So, from one year to the next, the tests are not always on the exact same date, or they're not going to correspond one to one with lectures. So, what I told you for this one, it's everything starting with topography or relief as a soil forming factor. So it'd be relief, parent material, time, and then the stuff on weathering and rocks and minerals. And then the stuff that we talked about Tuesday. Yeah, Hillary?
So when we talked about the north versus south facing aspects, we said the south had less effective rainfall or precipitation.
In the northern latitudes, yes.
And that's because evapotranspiration, or is there something else that I'm missing?
Well, it's related to the amount of solar insolation. So in the northern latitudes, if you have a south-facing slope and a north-facing slope, that north-facing slope is going to get much less solar radiation. And because of that, it's going to tend to be cooler. And the south-facing slope gets a lot more solar radiation or a lot more energy, and it tends to be effectively drier. Warmer and drier. Mateo?
In that condition, so another latitude, north and south slope, what affects more the development of a horizon? More soil, so temperature develop or speed up the rate, or more water?
Okay, so the question is, in the northern latitudes, with the north and south aspects, what's the effect on A horizons, right? And I'm going to give you the good it depends answer, because the example I showed you that was just taken down on the way to Lewiston, what you saw there is on the north facing slopes you had ponderosa pine and Douglas fir forest, and on the south facing slope it was primarily grasses or weeds and maybe some shrubs thrown in there too. So given that, you'd probably expect the better A horizon on the south facing slope, whereas the north facing slope, because it's got the trees on it, would have a O horizon and maybe not as well developed of an A horizon. So it really depends, you know, that, because there is the difference between having trees or grass. But if it was just grass on both the north and the south facing slope, I would say all other factors being equal, I'd expect a better A horizon on the north facing slope, just because there's more effective moisture, it's probably more productive. Okay? Anything else?
Hydrolysis,
okay.
When we go from,
was there a question on, I think there was.
I don't know.
Maybe not.
When we go from like a feldspar and with that hydrolysis, are we getting more, like we're just getting more kaolinite, right? Is that the idea?
Well, that's
potassium.
Yeah, that's the reaction by which the the potassium feldspar is, and it could be some of the other types of feldspars, it's weathered, and it's essentially attacked by a hydrogen ion that comes from the water. And so, yeah, the product is the kaolinite, and one of the other things in that reaction was potassium being released. So if you're a plant, that's kind of an important type of reaction, because that's one way that plant nutrients are made available to plants, is through that kind of weathering reaction. And it could be potassium, calcium, magnesium, any of those things. Anything else? You guys have done really well, almost 35 minutes of questions. Okay, well, I think we've pretty much covered all of this, so I hope everybody feels like they're pretty good shape for the exam. Okay, what we were talking about on Tuesday had to do with the development of soil taxonomy, and we sort of got up to the point where we said that you've got these different levels of the system, right? Orders down to soil series and even phases beyond that. And those are all characterized by increasing specificity. So in order to classify a soil, say to the series level or the family level, or even the higher levels of the system, we said that primarily it's going to be based on soil characteristics that can be observed or measured, and then in most cases it's quantitative, and that to a large extent the classification, where a soil goes in the system in terms of classification, is dictated by the presence or absence of these diagnostic horizons and features, and the soil moisture and temperature regimes. So clearly, to understand the system, we got to know something about diagnostic horizons and features. And I gave you this handout here that is a summary of some of this diagnostic horizons and features used in soil taxonomy. It's not a comprehensive, it's not a complete list. There's some others, but these definitely are the more common ones or the more important ones. And what I want to do is take the remainder of the time and at least get started on this. And then what I'm going to have you do for next time as an assignment is to, wherever we stop, is to go through the rest of these. Look them up in the textbook or soil taxonomy. You can find these a lot of places. And just come up with a general description of what these things refer to. And I think what you're going to find is that the names in most cases are going to evoke a particular thing. Like, for example, we talked about argillic horizon, and it means a zone of clay accumulation or a horizon of clay accumulation. We talked about argilland, so you know that root. And there'll be a few new ones, but for the most part, I think most of these will be familiar to you. And I don't want to go into a lot of detail about the quantitative limits on these things. We'll mention that a couple of times. But for the most part, we want to maybe think about these in terms of the types of horizons we've already talked about. Now, I made the point the other day that all argillic horizons are BT horizons, but not all BT horizons would qualify as argillic horizons, right? And keep that in mind for all of these. But for the most part, we can kind of think of them as being comparable. So, you know, if you think about argillic horizon, think about a BT horizon. And that's kind of the way these things fit together. So, if you want to look at the top of the list here, you can see I've got this split into three different sections. And the first section is, the heading is surface diagnostic horizons. And in parentheses, it says epipedons. Epi just means on top of or at the top of. Pedon means the soil. So this would be the top part of the soil. And I want to start off by saying that every soil in the world, every single one, has an epipedon, and it's one of the eight that are listed here. And you can see the list there, mollic, umbric, anthropic, pholistic, histic, plagon, melanic, ochric. Now, these, obviously, some are going to be more common than others, and I guess what we're going to try and do is focus on the ones that are more common. And the first one I put on the list is a Moloch epipedon, and we've already talked about this. If you just had to put into words what a Moloch epipedon is, what would you describe it as? Okay, thick, dark, a horizon, something like that. And that's exactly what it is. If you wanted to write a definition, you could say it's a thick, dark, organic matter, enriched, mineral horizon. Well, or it actually could be horizon. Sometimes if you have maybe an A1 and an A2 and an A3 horizon, all of those would be part of this Moloch epipedon. But these are the main features: thick, dark, organic matter enriched, and it's a mineral horizon as opposed to an organic horizon. Now, we get back to this idea of soil taxonomy being a quantitative system. So it's not good enough just to say it's thick. And if you read the criteria for a Moloch epipedon in the in soil taxonomy, there is going to be a quantitative limit. And in most cases, the Moloch epipedon has to be 25 centimeters or more. Now, there's always exceptions to these things, and I don't want to get bogged down with that. But in most cases, in most soils, it has to be at least 25 centimeters thick. The next part of that, dark. Well, how do you suppose we get at the dark part of this? Munsell. Yeah, and we use color. What aspect of Munsell color notation? Chroma is intensity, brightness, value. Yeah. So to qualify as a Moloch epipedon, the color value has to be at least, well, it can 5 or less when it's dry, and 3 or less when it's moist. Organic matter enriched, again, there's a quantitative limit, and this one's pretty simple. In most cases, you need to have at least 1% organic matter on a weight basis. It can be more than that, but at a minimum, 1%. And there's a few other things involved in the definition. Does anybody know what the Latin root for Moloch is? Yeah, it's mollus, which means soft. And part of the idea of a Moloch epipedon is that you don't have a very coarse type of structure. And in fact, most Moloch epipedons, you're going to have probably granular structure, and you're going to have a very friable material, or something that you might describe as soft as you're trying to work it in your hand. You know, we talked about rupture resistance. And so there's a few other criteria, but I think if you just remember this: thick, dark, organic matter enriched mineral surface. Now, if I offered a reward for the first person that could bring back a sample of a Moloch epipedon, where would you go?
Yard.
Yeah, just go right outside the building here, and I think you'd probably have a pretty good chance of finding one. Because we certainly have the 1% organic matter, we certainly have the dark colors, and the thickness might be the one thing. Anytime they've screwed around on a lawn, you never know, but all you need is 25 centimeters. Now, there's one other thing you need to put on here, too, that this, write it over here. The other part of this is we need greater than 50% base saturation. Now, I know this term has come up before. What do we mean when we say base saturation? Anybody want to stick their neck out?
I have no idea.
Okay, well, the idea of base saturation is, everyone remembers the concept of CEC, cation exchange capacity. Base saturation is simply the percentage of that cation exchange capacity that is occupied by calcium, magnesium, potassium, and even sodium. So those are the base cations. Calcium, magnesium, potassium are the main ones, and to a lesser extent, sodium. So it's just the proportion of those exchange sites that have those on it. So it's really a measure of fertility. If a soil has high base saturation, that means generally has lots of calcium, magnesium, and potassium. Those are all plant macronutrients. If it has low base saturation, maybe the fertility level is going to be not quite so high. So that's the one other thing on amylopeptidin. Okay, now, if you look at the next one on the list there, it says umbric. Now you're going to like this. This is exactly the same as a malic epipedon, except for one thing, and that is it has less than 50% base saturation. It's still dark, it's still thick, it still has at least 1% organic matter, but the base saturation is less than 50%. Now, I would be prepared to offer even greater reward for somebody that would bring back an umbric epipedon. Where would you go? Where do you think you could find a thick, dark, organic matter-enriched horizon that had kind of low base saturation? I don't think you'd find one around here in a farm field. I think to get into the situation where you've got less than 50% base saturation, you probably need to get up in higher precip areas. So I'd go up in the forest and maybe look for a forest meadow or type of environment where you would expect to have a lot of organic inputs through roots. That'd probably be your best bet. I suspect you get up in Moscow Mountain, you could probably find an umbric epipedon up there without too much difficulty. So that's easy, right? And the rest of these are going to be pretty easy. The third one on the list, Anthropic. Anthropic.
So does an umbric or a malic generally have more plant life? Like, would the malic have less, and so there's less of that, those nutrients being used?
No, I think of it more as a matter of leaching. That generally umbric epipedons come from higher rainfall environments, and therefore they've been subject to more leaching. So the calcium, magnesium, potassium have been lost to a greater extent. Okay, so this next one, Anthropic. What's the root in there that you recognize? Anthro meaning what?
People.
People have been involved with it. And an anthropic epipedon, again, it's almost exactly like a malic, except for one thing, and that is it has evidence of human disturbance. And that can take a lot of forms. You might have bricks or pottery, I don't know, things like that. But the other part of this, evidence of human disturbance, and one of the best ways to trace human activity is phosphorus, right? Because we tend to concentrate phosphorus, and as a result, this anthropic has greater than 1,500 parts per million of phosphate, P2O5. What would be sources of phosphorus?
Fertilizer.
Could be fertilizers. What about if you're thinking in terms of biological materials and have a lot of phosphorus in it? Bones? Yeah, would be one. Anyway, this anthropic epipedon is not that common. We do have them in the western United States, but the ones that I have seen tend to be associated with occupation sites, usually from Native Americans, because they tended to concentrate everything in one area. For example, In Montana, you might have buffalo jumps, where the Native Americans would run the buffalo off a cliff and let them collect down in the concave foot slope position. And so you'd have this big pile of buffalo bones, and then you'd have the settlement around it where they'd take the hides off and pretty much use all of the buffalo. But you would find these anthropic epipedons there because of the high phosphorus content. But again, it's more of something for occupation sites or human activity, but just like these others. Yeah?
So a plow layer wouldn't?
Not necessarily. It could, but you would have to have that. That's pretty high phosphorus content there. And I'd say there are probably going to be some ag fields that would get close to qualifying, but in general, it's going to take something else. Another example would be the eastern United States and coastal areas where people would collect shells and pile them up, and you might find these kitchen middens where there's a whole bunch of shells, and they have very high phosphorus. But anyway, these three things are very similar. Around here, the mollusk would definitely be the more common. And in fact, unless you're up in the forest, I would suggest that that's probably the main type of epipedon you're going to find. Okay, I'm going to stop here. So from here on out, take this with you, and for next time, go ahead and just fill in a real short definition of what these things are. Yeah?
Sorry, quick question about the test again. Should we know the names of all those men that we talked about last lecture?
The names of all those men?
Guy Smith and...
Well, you know that one.
Well, I know that one.
Dukachev, see, you know that one. I'm not going to make this a history test, so.
But they might be on there. You might see them.
I will say, in the past, there have been a couple of. I think I've always asked, who's the father of pedology? Yeah. So anyway, it's not really a history test.
I just forgot about that.
Would it be nice?
Okay, so do this for next time, and we'll get it finished up.
Some dude.